Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Issue 124. Craig Hamilton of CitizenCraig.com. Ben Stark of Wonder Mill Films.
Craig, how are you doing today?
What's your raccoon?
What's your raccoon? So we have a topic that I think will probably kind of evolve as we talk about it. It's something that's come up a number of times amongst the film nerds. And it's something you and I have talked about recently. And it's the idea of, there's a few different ways we could put it, warning signs or red flags, affectionately, we might call them our raccoons. It's basically ideas or things in movies that make us worried that the movie isn't going to be good. And then maybe some examples of times when that rang true or when it didn't. And context for the raccoon thing, we give Matt Scalise a hard time because before Guardians of the Galaxy came out, he was very negative about that movie and said a live-action movie with a talking raccoon in it can't be good. And now it's one of his favorite movies of all time, I believe. So it was a warning sign for him that was completely unfounded. So we're lovingly referring to this phenomena as a raccoon. you think that's a pretty good description of it?
No, that's perfect, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess I'll just throw it to you first. I mean, there's a few different ways we could do it. We could talk about, you know, instances with particular movies, or we could talk about categories of warning signs, or how do you want to start off?
Well, I was trying to think of specific instances of a raccoon that, you know, had me eating crow after I saw the film, and it was really hard to come up with that because I guess I just kind of, you know, when you forget you're wrong, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if I had ever been wrong, I would probably have forgotten it.
Exactly. So I think it might be one of those things. I immediately came up with some categorical things that have happened recently with movies, or that I've just kind of grown to just kind of, in the same way when a director comes out with a new movie, I'm like, oh, I have to see this movie because this guy is directing it. In the same way, I'm like, oh, I really don't know if I can see this movie because this person is in it or this person directed it. So it's sort of like raccoons in a way that something that makes me not want to see it, though if I did give it a shot, I very well may like it. So I was able to kind of think more broadly along those lines than I was specific instances, like a talking raccoon in a live-action movie.
Right.
So to answer your question, maybe categorically, unless you have specific instances where you...
If they come up, I'll mention them. But yeah, I think I was doing the same thing. I was trying to think of specific instances, and I realized, honestly, it's more these kind of general things that I have hang-ups with, right or wrong, and groups of movies kind of get lumped into that. But go ahead. What's your first kind of family of, what's your favorite? I don't know. What is a group of raccoons called? Is it a nest?
Well, we can start with something that sort of happened recently. Maybe it's slightly relevant with the Rogue One reshoots.
Yeah.
And would that count?
Absolutely. That was definitely one of mine where it's a trouble.
Okay, good.
You know?
Yeah, because I know whenever a film, a film is getting made and then, you know, at the 11th hour, it comes out that, oh, well, they had to completely re-edit the whole thing. That makes me all but vow to not see it because it's almost never a good sign. There have been a couple of instances where you hear of a movie getting re-edited at the last minute, and it turns out really good. But mostly it's not a very good sign. But the Rogue One was just completely being reshot for a lot of it.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's a whole different conversation we've had about that. So,
right.
But yeah, I mean, I think there's I guess the two sides of that coin that I'll cite are is one where I thought, well, this is going to be a piece of trash and I don't want to see it because I've heard the production has been troubled and it's not something that interests me anyway, but my wife and my friends want to see it, so I'll go with them. And that's World War Z. That one had a big ending reshuffling and everything. And that was a movie that turned out to be just fine. You know, it was not a disaster. So that was an unfounded concern there. But then I heard the same thing about Fantastic Four, probably one of the more famous recent examples right. of this. And in my opinion, I finally did catch up with that movie, and the production troubles are all over that thing. You can just totally tell from a bad wig to you know, storylines that are just kind of conveyed in computer screens rather than, you know, through actual scenes. It's just one of those where it's clearly they kind of had to patch together what they thought were the best things that they had. So I think that's one of those that's definitely been founded and unfounded in several situations. I'm trying to think of some other ones where I heard about the trouble, thought, oh man, this is going to be a mess, and it turned out to be wrong, but I can't pull any off the top of my head. I feel like often that's almost kind of accurate, but I do think it speaks to kind of the stupid bias that we have, you know, and where we feel like we're so enlightened by the stuff that we can make decisions on these movies ahead of time. So I think that's one of the, I think most of these honestly are going to reflect way more on me as a bad, stupid person than on the movies themselves.
Right. Yeah. You know, another, it's kind of a similar category, I think, is when a movie is not screened for critics.
Right. Yes.
I think those are kind of the same, but it's almost like they don't even bother to re-edit or reshoot or do anything. They're just like, let's go with it. Let's just not let anybody see it.
Yeah, they just know that what they've got isn't working. So they're like, well, let's just avoid the inevitable slaughter that is going to be a critic's review of this. But now you're getting studios like Disney that have so much confidence in their work that they refuse to screen for critics just because they don't want to, even though they know they've got something good.
Yeah, well, if a Kevin James movie or an Adam Sandler movie is screened for critics, then it's a shocker these days, it seems like.
But
so you've got studios that don't really care anymore because they've got so much clout, or they've got, you know, they've built their empire on, you know, really good movies. But I say, if I remember correctly, I'm not sure if Million Dollar Baby was screened for critics or not. I know it just snuck up on everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it was even finished. I mean, I think they're editing that right up until the like Christmas or something like that.
Yeah, that was
one where you couldn't even have any biases because it just kind of crept up on you.
Yeah, and there have been examples where movies don't get screened and end up being really good, but those must not be for reasons because they know the movie sucks. And I think a lot of those movies that aren't screened for critics are just they're just. They don't want the negativity out, obviously, before people can pay a bunch of money to go see it.
Yeah, and I mean, you bring up those, and that. I mean, we can come back to that category if you'd like, but it almost segues nicely into a different category, which is just entire filmographies of actors, of certain actors. I don't know what you would have to do to me to make me watch a Kevin James movie or an Adam Sandler movie at this point, you know? There was a time in my life where I felt obliged to watch every new movie that came out.
Sure.
At that time was called college. And I am too old for that. And I don't have the time to make time for anything that doesn't look pretty great. And so there are entire actors that their work, I don't know what you would, again, I don't know what you'd have to do to me to make me watch that. So if you tell me that a Kevin James movie is coming out, I guess that's a big warning sign for me because I don't think I've ever even seen any of his movies and I have no desire to see them. And certainly Adam Sandler at this point is a big red flag. And I'm sure there's plenty of other actors. I think one situation where this totally backfired, I think, for most of us, is The Matrix. You know, where in 1999 we'd all kind of written Keanu Reeves off as this failed action star and didn't have a whole lot to offer. You know, I think his last movie was Johnny Mnemonic, and we were all wrong. You know, that ended up being a total change for him, and he's turned out to be a totally serviceable action star, and a pretty interesting movie star in his own right. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure I could think of several other examples. Obviously, Adam Sandler has Punch Drunk Love. A lot of people.
Without that, we may have never had Lake House.
Right, Lake House, or
so.
The Day After Tomorrow, or the Earth Stood Still remake. Classic.
You mentioned Punch Drunk Love. So if we had made this, I think probably the Adam Sandler raccoon role for me, Paul, and maybe you as well, came into effect after Punch Drunk Love. Maybe not though. But if I had vowed not to watch an Adam Sandler movie, I would have missed out on a really, really, really great movie, in my opinion. But that's Paul Thomas Anderson. Really knows how to direct people.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think I may have tapped out on Sandler pretty early on. I think Big Daddy was the last of his movies that I watched.
Oh yeah,
yeah, and then yeah. Little Nicky. Yeah. I think the trailer for that, I was like, oh, okay, now I'm out. And I don't know if I've ever really gone back.
No, I definitely have not. I think I might have seen
50 First Dates. I did see 50 First Dates.
No, I saw that, yeah.
But again,
I was
think
in
about
college.
Punch Drunk Love was, yeah, me too. Punch Drunk Love was the same year as 8 Crazy Nights. And that seems like the, you know, the perfect example of the Adam Sandler red flag.
Right. Right, right. But, you know, the thing is, though, I don't know about you, but I was really into his comedy albums in high school.
Oh yeah, middle school. That's like every school trip that I went on, we just passed those things around like they were contraband. It was fantastic.
Oh, man.
The GOAT.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean...
Sorry, I got a phone ringing.
No problem. The app.
Yeah.
Do you need to take that?
No. I'm sorry. I was just looking at what came before Punch Drunk Love. I guess some Mr. Deeds was the same year as Punch Drunk Love.
Yeah, my wife is a huge fan of Mr. Deeds. I mean, another actor on my red flag raccoon list is, for better or worse, and again, this is just going to reveal kind of how petty I am and not anything about this person, but Paul Dano is an actor that, for whatever reason, I just can't get on board with. From Little Miss Sunshine to There Will Be Blood, he has been a bit of a... I just haven't been able to buy into any of his performances. And I know that he's recently had Love and Mercy, which was very well reviewed. He plays, Ryan Wilson.
This is a good raccoon. No,
yeah?
I have not. But this is a good raccoon example because... I see what you're saying with Paul Dano, and you're definitely not alone in that. But I think he is a good actor, and I think this is a good and we can change the terminology. We don't always have to call this raccoon if you don't want to, but for lack of a better word,
I'm saying all sorts of different stuff.
So I think Paul Dano is a good raccoon because he's such a good actor that he's going to give a good performance every now and then that the haters will miss out on inevitably. And that's probably going to be Swiss Army Man.
Yeah,
no, I'm just
kidding. That's the movie that I feel like, well, this may pull me back into really, you know, watching one of his, actively seeking out one of his movies because that conceit is strong enough that I'm intrigued by it. And I mean, he keeps making these choices that it's like, ugh. And it's happened before. I mean, Leonardo DiCaprio used to be a raccoon for me. You know, I think for many people, where he was in the late 90s, we just thought he was this heartthrob. And then he drops Gangs of New York and Catch Me If You Can in the same season. And it's like, well, crap, now I guess I got to like this guy. And he is no longer a warning sign. Now he's actually he's something that draws me to movies.
Yeah. There are several raccoons that, I know I'm going to, you know, I'm potentially may miss out on good movies. And I have to just bite the bullet sometimes and get over it. One of those would be Anne Hathaway for me. As you and many know, I despise that woman. Despise her. But listen, even The Devil Wears Prada was on the other day, and I don't hate that movie. I was sort of surprised when that movie came out because I didn't hate it, although I despise her. But I was pulling for Emily Blunt the whole time. So there's that going for. But there's other movies that I'm sure she's done that are good besides The Devil Wears Prada. Les Mis, I thought maybe she was a little, hey, I'm glad I saw that movie. But listen, I can't pretend to like her. She's a raccoon, positively, in essence. But it's one of those where I understand that I could be missing out on something with that.
Yeah, there's a few other actors. Miles Teller is one that kind of keeps popping. I keep seeing movies that he's in, and I keep not really buying into his performances. But for some stupid reason, I keep seeing the bad ones, like Fantastic Four. And I still have not caught up with Whiplash, and I feel like that is clearly the one that everybody has praised enough and the filmmaking behind it seems so strong that I should really catch up with that. But then he's got that movie War Dogs that's coming out this year, and it looks like a complete nightmare because it's combined with another one of my – well, again, it's a guy that I keep seeing in movies, and even though he doesn't draw me to them, and that's Jonah Hill. It's complex. I think you and I are being very honest with ourselves here and saying that these are personal issues that we have, and we probably need to get into counseling and take
probably,
care of them.
Speaking of counseling, Shia LaBeouf is a raccoon that I don't ever care if I could miss out on the best movie ever made if he's in it. I don't care. I'm willing to accept that.
Yeah, he's never been a big one for me. I haven't really minded him. I think the only time I've shut down during one of his performances is in the Transformers movies, and I feel like there it's because he's being directed by Michael Bay, whose primary direction is just to scream at the top
and
of your lungs.
And he's another raccoon.
Yeah, he should be one probably for me. He should be a big red flag, but I will see every new Michael Bay movie because I do. There is something in his filmmaking that I'm drawn to. And I just watched 13 Hours, and I feel like that's a pretty good movie. And he has earned himself. We've lowered the flag from red to kind of purple, on him, where it's like, there's dangerous marine life, but not necessarily sharks or like, deadly undertows.
Yeah, and he can do good things. I think it depends on what he's doing. Transformers, no, but something like this, a completely non-sensitive subject like the Benghazi attack.
Right. Well, here's the thing. I think if he is afraid of getting beaten up by the people he's making the movie about, he'll make a good movie. But he knows the Transformers aren't coming after him, so he can make them into clowns.
Right.
While we're on directors, I've recently had to be real honest with myself and say that two directors that are total red flags for me now that I may be done with their films completely for a while is Zack Snyder after Batman v Superman and Matthew Vaughn after The Kingsman, especially Matthew Vaughn movies co-written or based on material written by Mark Millar, the comic writer and now kind of screenwriter wannabe guy. After watching The Kingsman, which is just so unbelievably ugly and trashy and a missed opportunity, I was just like, wow, I've looked at Matthew Vaughn's filmography. I like X-Men First Class. That's it. Everything else is just this mishmash of tones and this kind of juvenile, wannabe cool garbage. that I'm just done. You know, I'm done with this guy, and it's not a Michael Bay thing where the filmmaking is so, in some ways, masterful that I'm coming back, even though the material is so crass and ugly. There's just nothing redeemable, aside from a few neat sequences here and there, and I gotta tap out, and it's weird. So Mark Millar may be the bigger red flag there, but Matthew Vaughn, by association, is on my director raccoon list.
Yeah, I agree with Zack Snyder, just because I think it may be personal. I just don't like what he does. I thought Watchmen was okay because I love that graphic novel.
Right.
Anything I love to see adaptations of what I read, even if they're sucky adaptations. I like to see kind of what I've envisioned in my head. I like to see what someone else has been able to play out. So in regards to things like that, there's an appreciation for that, but just a lack of taste and kind of just a control over, you know, just instead of throwing cans of paint on a canvas, which is, to me, that's kind of like what his movies are. It's just an unguarded, just kind of a free for all of darkness and slow-mo or quick zoom pops and what have you. So did I put enough negativity in one sentence?
You could keep going, but we probably should move on.
I should get some notes together before, or else I'll just be saying words.
Well,
one after the other.
For Zack Snyder, I mean, again, my big issue with him is not just the fact that his worldview is so nihilistic that I have issues with that, but also as a feature film director, as a short film or commercial director, I think he probably is really strong, but as a feature film director, he just can't put things together in a cohesive way for 2 hours. And it seems like that's kind of my same issue with Matthew Vaughn. There's just this tonal, exquisite corpse thing going on. I guess to bring it back to Swiss Army Man. But going topical again, something, a big warning sign for me often and for a lot of people is probably massive, massive amounts of CGI. And Warcraft is probably a recent example. I've heard good things and I've heard bad things about that movie, but I'll probably stay away as far as the theater goes just because it just looks like such a non-tactile experience. And I've been wrong about this before because I could have said the same thing about Peter Jackson's Hobbit trilogy, which I really like, and also
that's right.
Rise of the Planet of the Apes is one where I was like, you know, everything is so digital in that movie. Why would I care about it? But then you see it and the performances and the script and the directing are so good that, well, I'm on board. So it doesn't matter that you're covered in digital effects.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think in instances like that, the Hobbit would have been my example of where had I not broken my vow of CGI movies, that I would have missed out on something great. And the Planet of the Apes movies are another great example. But I think in instances like that, it's almost like mentally I bounce my list of raccoons up against my list of directors I have to see, and it's the director list trumps that. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So I guess Matt Reeves did Planet of the Apes, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes,
Dawn
right?
Of the Planet.
So, you know,
right.
And I wasn't huge on Cloverfield, but I really did like Let Me In. I thought that was a really good remake of that other Let the Right One In.
Right.
Plus, and Rise of the Planet of the Apes was so good. So, yeah, completely. It's almost, there are other forces out there to keep our raccoon list in check or to keep our, you know, neurotic, self-loathing in check.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean,
definitely one for me.
Well, I mean, not to stray from movies, but I mean, it's Game of Thrones is one that's something that I've gotten nagged by Ben Flanagan so many times because I just don't have any interest in watching that show. And part of that is because TV is hard to commit to, and I'm going to die someday, so I'd rather watch a bunch of good movies than one TV series. But this week there was apparently this big, massive battle scene on Game of Thrones that sounds like it was really interestingly done, and I'm curious to check that out. Will I go back and watch the entire series up to that point? Probably no, I don't want to. But yeah, I definitely have a weird personal hang-up with a lot of TV shows, especially Game of Thrones for some reason, and I just can't make myself watch it. And
would you say to a degree that TV itself is a raccoon for you?
Absolutely. I will be totally honest to have a bias against television because the narrative is so open-ended, and the great thing about cinema is that it's closed. It's, you know, it's an hour and a half to 2 hours of a single narrative experience, and you don't have to leave plot threads hanging, or if you do, if they're well addressed, then you can, you know, address them in interesting conversations with people after the movie. And in general, cinema is not purely a narrative art form, so there's so much more you can do. But in TV, you have to make it a narrative experience, or you're wasting advertiser money or subscriber money and all these other things. There's just so many other masters in television to serve other than the medium itself. I'm not a plot junkie, and I think the TV is kind of a plot-driven thing. So, yeah, that's a natural hang-up for me. It takes a lot for me to commit to a TV show. You know, oftentimes it pays off, great and bad, obviously. I'm a fan of Justified as well. And, you know, there's plenty of half-hour TV shows out there that I've been addicted to. The Simpsons is, you know, early Simpsons is one of the great, you know, loves of my life. But in terms of these, good Lord, like 7-season shows where every episode is an hour long, and it's just, and I think, here's the thing, here's a big, big old raccoon for me. In movie series or in TV series, if the most of the conversation about something is about what character is going to die, I'm out. Like that, I shut down, because that is such lazy, I mean, talk about a narrative, it's such a lazy narrative tension. And I feel like that's so much of TV and movies. I mean, when The Dark Knight Rises came out, that was most of the kind of chatter before the movie. It was if Batman was going to die or not. It's like, well, who really cares? Like, the tension should not be whether a character is going to die or not. The tension should be, you know, how it affects other characters and the dynamics, and yet that seems to be, in this golden age of TV, that seems to be the major talking point on so many of these shows, is who's going to die next.
So not to change the topic of our podcast or our this episode of FNU from something raccoon related to just a TV thing, but when a series is established and been around for some years, the death of one character does affect other characters.
Right, but so often it's not about how that happens, it's about who's going to die next. I mean, 24 is an example of a TV show that I bailed on because it was all about, well, anybody can die, and Lost became about that eventually too, and that really hurt that show. And that's so much of the dialogue around Game of Thrones, again, right or wrong, this is my personal hang-up, is about, oh, this guy died, or, ooh, all these people, everybody died. This one episode, nobody lived. And the next episode, only babies that were newborn were the only cast members because everybody died. This show is badass. It's just so dumb.
I was talking,
and so shallow.
I was talking to someone today, actually, about Game of Thrones and how I don't particularly enjoy that author's writing style, so I only read the first book. And plus, I had a hang-up because some really great characters, like perhaps the only great characters, were killed off. And a coworker mentioned to me, that's what's so great. That's what he does. He builds up a character, develops them, makes them your favorite, and then kills them. And I'm like, that doesn't sound like something I want to watch at all.
Yeah, you know what, that sounds
wasting my time.
That sounds like real life. People die in real life that I love. I don't need to go to a TV show, make a meaningful relationship just to watch that person die in front of me.
Yeah.
It's a problem. I mean, to steer it back to movies, I guess the bigger thing here is maybe sequels, you know, of these kind of never-ending,
right. Yeah.
These never-ending expanded universe things where it's like, well, you know, again, going back to Batman, Superman, like, I have a feeling that I'm not going to get a ton of closure on anything in this movie because I've heard so much about how it's leading up to Justice League. And obviously I'm a huge Marvel fan, so I should probably be fair and say that movies like Thor the Dark World, too, or movies where, you know, I feel like I could probably skip that movie because it's not playing into the greater Avengers narrative. But I'd be wrong because those movies are still individually satisfying.
And that's the sequel thing was something I was going to bring up too. Because there's a lot of discussion, amongst the film nerds regarding just the titling of those sequels. Like the sequel itself is a problem. It's an epidemic. There's too many sequels. We all get that. And I think we all understand that and agree. But the convention to which they come up with these titles, there's very little creativity. It's all kind of, everyone's kind of going after the same thing. It's title colon something else.
Yes.
Or Rise of, or
yes.
Dawn of, which, and if that's your raccoon, you're missing out on some really good movies. You know, The Dark Knight Rises, Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I mean, that's just, sometimes I feel like, and you probably know more about this than I do, that's taken out of the decision, the hands of the director or the writer.
Well,
that's maybe
a lot of the times it is, but then you watch the movie The Dark Knight Rises, and that title makes perfect sense. It, like, makes the perfect sense for the entire trilogy, and it's because the filmmaker knew what he was doing and had control over things. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, Ben Flanagan and I have had you know, arguments about this going way back, with especially that kind of those naming conventions. One time that I was extremely wrong about this was in 2003, Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. I thought, boy, what a awful, cumbersome title that does nothing to really tell you anything about the movie, but does everything to try to set up a movie franchise. And then you watch that movie, and although the title still isn't necessary, it could just be called Master and Commander, and that's how I refer to that movie usually. But it's a great movie. You know, the name of that movie could have been, you know, Hungry Captain Jack's Ship Sail-a-thon 2000, and it still would be a great movie despite an odd, cumbersome title.
And instead, that's the next Pirates title anyway, so it's good that they didn't.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the next Pirates of the Caribbean movie is called Pirates of the Caribbean, : Dead Men Tell No Tales. I think the spelling of men hesitation is even in there, maybe, that I just threw out. So, I mean, that's like, you need two theater marquees to put the name of the movie up there.
They almost are taking the tagline on the poster.
Right, yeah, it's the plot synopsis from IMDb.
Yeah.
After colon. Yeah.
It's a letterbox review that they're just adding it as the title. You know,
exactly.
And speaking of Master and Commander, Paul Bettany came awfully close to being a raccoon for me.
Yeah. Yeah. He had a bad run there where it was like, well, why would I go see a Paul Bettany movie? And then Marvel saved him.
Yeah. So going back to Matt's original hang up with the talking raccoon in Guardians of the Galaxy, I totally get where he's coming from, completely, because any movie where animals' mouths are moved to make them look like they're talking, and then there's like a voiceover of dialogue that is supposed to be coming from them, I'm not going to go see that movie. What was it called? Stripes or Race? What was that movie called? Stripes.
Racing Stripes?
Racing Zebra?
The Racing Zebra movie?
No, the Bill Murray movie, yes. Yeah, the Racing Stripes. That's what... you know, stuff like that. I'm not going to...
Speaking of Bill Murray, that's something that Graham and I talked about last year when we talked about the trailer for The Jungle Book, which is these photoreal animals with their dead behind the eye, you know, marble eyes, you know, with emoting and really... and that movie is pretty good.
The Zemeckis eyes?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Just the shark eyes that, you know, you don't expect these things to emote. That, the Jungle Book is a pretty good movie, but yeah, there is something I do prefer there to be a measure of illustrative quality to it. You know, it's the Uncanny Valley thing. You know, if Rocket Raccoon, even in Guardians of the Galaxy, if Rocket Raccoon was a little bit more, you know, cartoonish, I think I would even have a better time with it. But I mean, it's really hard to complain because, you know, in the moments where that character gets emotional, it totally plays. And he's walking on two legs, which helps.
Yeah.
For me, a similar way is anthropomorphized things that aren't bipedal. So even Finding Nemo and Finding Dory, it takes me a little bit to really invest myself in these things that don't walk with their legs and you know, move things with their arms and hands. Cars is obviously a rightfully difficult one to wrestle with. There's a reason that, you know, we don't anthropomorphize just anything, because there needs to be some sort of human anatomy there for us to tie into and to relate with. Unless the story and the characters are so good that you can't help but invest yourself.
Right. And as you know, I am a huge Cars fan, but whenever I watch that movie, I have to kind of suppress thousands of questions that my brain is asking me, you know, in regards to, well, if they do this as cars that can live and breathe and talk and converse, there's a million other contradictions in anatomy and just logic of that world that would really bug me if I let it.
Right. Like, when exactly did all the vehicles murder the humans?
Right.
And if she's attracted to the tattoo on her bumper or whatever, like, what? Like, how does sexual attraction work in general? Yeah, it's troubling.
Like, you know, he can't fill himself up with gas.
Right.
So... how do you eat?
You eat all of us eat, where I get a friend to shove a straw into my stomach and push food into it.
Oh, okay. Well, then that makes sense. Then.
Yeah. You know.
Right.
Last time we all got together, that's how we fed each other pizza. Don't you remember?
That's why we got so dehydrated.
Exactly. Yeah. We forgot to shove water in after. There's definitely hang-ups there. I agree with the whole lifelike animals moving their lips and talk. I almost prefer the Homeward Bound, just shoot the damn plate of the animal without moving its lips.
Kick it until it walks in the direction you need to go.
Right, yeah. So throw bacon off screen.
Do they talk in Jungle Book?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Bill Murray, Scarlett Johansson, yep.
I'll see that movie because I like that story and I want to see that movie. So there are times when
It helps too that everything in that movie is so digital that it heightens. It didn't look like it in the trailer, but there is an illustrative quality to it. Idris Elba as Shere Khan is extremely effective. He's one of the best characters of the year so far, I would say.
And I think the same could be said for Rocket Raccoon and Guardians of the Galaxy, because that kind of his ability to speak, that effect actually to me blends in with the CGI around it, because there is so much. It's not all CGI, putting it into that other raccoon list, but there's enough CGI around, I think, to where I don't notice the raccoon
right.
raccoon's mouth moving as a it doesn't stick out to me.
But, you know, there's so much color, and yeah, it's definitely a heightened reality.
And animal movies to me really have sort of been raccoons, all the way back down to like the Shaggy Dog and Benji, up through like Old Yeller, just really movies about animals, like real life animals.
Yeah, I don't think you do. I don't think you like animals. Because you guys don't own a pet, right?
Oh, but I grew up with pets. We just haven't we just haven't lived in a place where we felt we could own a pet and give it what it needed as far as space.
Really?
And,
I mean, you live in War Horse. Your backyard is the opening credits of War Horse. So we just
moved there. And that's not all my property.
Ah.
So, but I mean, it could.
Well,
run,
I'm totally the opposite. You put an animal in a movie, and it's like a floating 7 out of 10 for me. It's up to the movie to fail.
Did you like those Benji movies?
Yeah, I didn't ever watch a ton of them, but I liked them. But the movie, have you ever seen Jean-Luc Godard's The Bear?
Yes.
Yeah, that movie's great. I was a big fan of that movie when I was a kid. But yeah, like the Homeward Bound movies and Beethoven. Were just animals just, you know, F shit up. It's just great. Great.
I guess what I mean is where the movie centers around an animal, like the Beethoven movies or...
War Horse. You can say it.
But there are exceptions. There are exceptions. But one is, and I didn't want to watch this, but I had to because it was nominated for Best Picture. It was Sounder.
Uh-huh. Never
That's a great film. That's a great film. Martin Ritt directed it. It's not really centered around the animal, though, and that's what I was expecting. It's more about this kid. And there's just a dog following around, which is fine. I hate dogs, but as long as they're in the background, I'm fine with it. But.
Preferably dead. Preferably in a pile dead. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, any other raccoon? Oh, you mentioned 24 back on TV for a second. Elisha Cuthbert is the biggest raccoon I've ever seen in my life.
Is she still working? I don't think she's been in anything. And that you're literally talking about the amount of mascara she wears, I think is what you're saying.
She literally fell in the garbage can.
Right, yeah. Yeah. She eats garbage. She was in The Great Outdoors. I'm trying to think of any big ones. I feel like we did a pretty good job covering it. I'm trying to think if there's any other actors or anything like that. But honestly, I think overall, this phenomenon has kind of gone down in frequency for me over the years because, like I said earlier, at this point, I kind of just avoid anything that doesn't look tasteful to me. Like, I look at my ratings for movies every year, and I'm like, golly, I rate a lot of things very highly. And then I have to remind myself, that's because I almost only watch stuff that I know I'm going to like, which I know is not the mature, you know, critical way to watch films as an adult. But at the same time, I mean, the stuff I'm watching is actually pretty good. You know, it's the best art house stuff or the best foreign or the best blockbuster stuff that I can drum up. But I just don't take that many risks anymore. If something, you know, has a stench to me, has the stench of a raccoon digging through the garbage, pretending to talk, I'm just going to avoid it. I'm a grown up. Yeah, I'll do what I want.
Same here. You know, in college, my yearly movie list, the movies that I watched went from, I think it was in the upper 90s one year. And in the last 10 years, I think it's gone down to as low as in the 20s.
Yeah,
a lot of that has to do with kids, having a kid, but most of it is I'm not wasting my time on movies I don't think I'm going to like.
Yep. I mean, you mentioned 50 First Dates earlier, and that was, for me too, that was like the prime, where I was like, well, I got to go see Starsky and Hutch, you know?
Right.
I mean, I just, you know, I've got to have my comprehensive list at the end of the year, and I got to give Todd Phillips his fair shake. So, yeah, I mean, that's that's we're getting old. And why do things that we don't want to do? You know?
That's right. We have become our own raccoons. We're raccoons for ourselves.
For more Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.